It would have been natural to select Cliff Stoll out of a lineup of suspected computer fanatics. Skinny Cliff had a maniacal edge to his personality, cultivating what might even be a parody of the eccentric scientist. Wild corkscrews of brown hair projected 6 inches from his head. He had the gait of a pogo stick, a yo-yo always in hand and in perpetual motion. Stoll's speech was punctuated by a parade of exclamations. "Hot ziggity!" and "Holy smokes!" "Geez!" and "Really, really neat!" If his computer kept him waiting for more than half a second before executing a command, he would yell, "Commie!" at it. In fact, "Commie" was the mocking charge leveled against any recalcitrant inanimate object. Stoll's political views leaned appropriately leftward, in part because it never occurred to him to think otherwise. He went to college during the 1960s, and he opposed the Vietnam War, but he wasn't much of an active crusader for the left. In fact, he considered himself a non-ideologue who resisted left-wing dogma. He operated more on his principles. It was on principle, for instance, that he made certain that all of his employers were involved in nothing but the purest of research. He couldn't bring himself to work for the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, a government research center whose bread-and-butter projects included designing nuclear warheads and Star Wars weapons for the U.S. military, to say nothing of the National Security Agency, whose computer scientists were, by definition, spies. So in 1986, Stoll took a postdoctoral job at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, designing mirrors for the Keck Observatory in Hawaii. LBL is Livermore's sister laboratory, 30 miles to the west. LBL is one of the United States' national research labs and the site of broad-based unclassified scientific research. When Stoll's grant money ran dry in late 1986, he was forced to look for something else to do. For an astronomer in the midst of the Reagan era, it wasn't an unusual fate. Federal money to support the basic sciences was shrinking. The money was over the hill, literally, at the weapons laboratories. As it happened, the computer knowledge Stoll had picked up in high school and college gave him a certain advantage over other astronomers who lost their funding. In August 1986, he became a system administrator in charge of maintaining the laboratory's dozen mainframe computers. This meant being responsible for everything from backing up important data and taking care of computer security to helping the scientists who were his customers use the powerful machines more efficiently. Although it wasn't exactly the work he was looking for, it allowed him to stay in Berkeley. One of his first assignments seemed simple enough: to reconcile a small accounting error that had shown up. LBL used some home-brewed accounting software, and the patchwork of programs written by summer students over the years had come up with a 75-cent discrepancy between the normal system accounting and the lab's own charging scheme. Cliff stayed at work until midnight, puzzling over the mysterious 75-cent error, which he suspected might be a computational rounding error. After careful examination, he discovered it wasn't a rounding error, but the work of an unauthorized person from outside the lab using the account of an LBL researcher who had left several months earlier. With characteristic gusto, Cliff became a self-appointed one-man SWAT team. He set up traps that captured the hacker's every keystroke on a printer and alerted him every time the intruder was in the computer. He kept a detailed logbook, and he wrote a software program that tripped his pocket pager whenever the trespasser logged on. Before long, he was doing little else but tracking the uninvited guest. Occasionally, he even slept in his sleeping bag on the office floor to keep a constant vigil over the hacker. Finding an intruder on a computer system is often as serendipitous as guessing the correct password to break into a system. Detecting a break-in can be a matter of timing, perseverance, and ultimately luck, especially if the trespasser takes steps to cover his tracks. It requires the same skills that the hacker himself employs, and it can often mean getting inside the hacker's head to anticipate his next move. A system manager like Cliff Stoll hunts down an intruder not only because computer security has been broken, it's also a matter of wounded pride and a threat to the institution's ability to keep its doors to the outside world open and keep hackers out at the same time. Stoll gradually began to understand the hacker's strategy. By exploiting mistakes in the way LBL's computer managers had installed certain software, the intruder had managed to give himself privileges on the system that are usually reserved for system managers. As a result, the intruder was able to create accounts with names such as Hunter and Jaeger, assigning them such passwords as Benson and Hedges. And the hacker was careful. Every few minutes, he typed the command WHO, which listed everyone on the computer. Evidently, he knew how to log out in a hurry. If the hacker thought he detected a legitimate system operator on the computer, or someone else with full privileges in a single keystroke, he could instantly disappear back into the electronic beyond. Stoll didn't know, of course, whether it was indeed just one hacker plaguing his computers or a gang. Some empirical evidence seemed to support the case for just one hacker, but he wanted to be certain. So he set up a scientific probe to see if he could discern typing patterns from among 30 colleagues at the lab. Once he decided he could, he applied the same test to the hacker's typing rhythms and discovered that most of the time the typing came across the telephone lines in methodical, evenly spaced strokes. Only occasionally was the typing more random, as if someone might be hunting for the keys. He didn't pause to consider that by the time the keystrokes had been transmitted through intermediate computers and data networks, all of the information that could identify the typist had long since disappeared. The most obvious solution to the problem would have been to lock the hacker out entirely, and that would have been simple. Stoll needed only to change all the lab's passwords and tweak a piece of software called GNU Emacs that ran on LBN computers. A powerful programmer's text editing program, GNU Emacs, was used by nearly everyone at LBL. Because LBL programmers had installed GNU Emacs on the lab's computers in a way that gave a user special privileges, any user could access any file on the system using a command called movemail. In effect, LBL created a hole in computer security, an effective window into normally inaccessible areas within the computer, and the hacker had discovered this. Stoll was beside himself. He decided that instead of slamming the door and keeping the hacker out, he would let him roam through the system with relative freedom and catalog his every move, and then trap him. He reasoned that by keeping the system open, he could get the hacker to stay on the line long enough to let the phone company trace him back to his lair. What really was the danger of an interloper browsing around anyway? The information on the system was often personal, but, as far as the LBL system was concerned, not vital for national security. The hacker could peruse grant proposals and information about the computer system, as well as electronic mail carrying gossip, news, and love letters. Stoll's salary and resume were open for browsing, too. To Stoll, the problem was not so much the hacker's rummaging around the LBL computers as his use of that computer to ricochet his way to other computers over the ARPANET, to virtually anywhere in the Internet. With the simple command, Telnet, the hacker could instruct the LBL computer to connect to Internet computers anywhere in the world, at military bases and Pentagon contractors and research laboratories. He had only to come up with an account and password for those computers. In fact, the hacker was losing interest in the Berkeley machines and was just using them as a launchpad to others, especially those on MILNET, the unclassified military network connecting Defense Department installations. Given Stoll's studious avoidance of military matters, he had no real idea what went on in those computers, but their locations alone sounded like serious business. Redstone Missile Command in Alabama, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, Anniston Army Depot, Navy installations in Virginia and Florida, and the Air Force Systems Command Space Division in El Segundo, California. Not only was the hacker logging on, but he was directing his searches in an ominous way. He told the computer to seek out files containing such words as stealth, nuclear, and NORAD. He latched on to files about the space shuttle's secret missions. Stoll had heard a lot of stories about hackers from colleagues at Stanford, 50 miles south of the San Francisco Peninsula, and Fermilab, near Chicago. But they had struck him as harmless pranksters. This interloper seemed different. Stoll was stunned by the hacker's ability to traverse the nation, nudging computers open just by guessing obvious passwords. The nation's computers appeared to be surprisingly unprotected. A guest account, for instance, might have guest as its login and guest as its password. Or the login might be a user's last name, the password his first. So the hacker could ask the computer to show him a list of users on the system, then try breaking in simply by typing in people's names. On the handful of occasions that the hacker managed to give himself super-user status, he would create his own accounts or change passwords of existing accounts for his future use. When the hacker hopped over the network to a computer at Lawrence Livermore, Stoll panicked. He called Lawrence Livermore and told the system manager to shut down that machine.